We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another super strong player, joining us this week. He is one of England's top players, the three-time British champion, was the youngest to earn the GM title in UK history, peak rating of 2712, which was top 50 in the world. And these days, he's been getting more involved in chess media. He is now the chess columnist for The Times and the Sunday Times of London, was one of the broadcasters of Gibraltar Chess. He's been doing occasional banter blitzes for Chess 24 to great acclaim. And he recently released an instructional DVD with Ginger GM called Winning Grandmaster Methods, How I Got to 2700, which I've been checking out and enjoying greatly, and we will be discussing. But without further ado, let's bring him in. Grandmaster David Howell, how are you today?
Yeah, hey, everyone. And thanks for having me, Ben. Yeah, I'm good today. You're making it sound like I'm really busy and that I've done a lot with life. But these days, you know, during the lockdown, it feels like every day is just like the next. So this is a nice way to break things up. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, for some reason, I'm having not having any trouble getting guests lately with with everyone stuck at home. I definitely hear where you're coming from, although your accomplishments do speak for themselves. But yeah, a lot of time on our hands.
Yeah, that's right. We no excuses to say no to things.
Exactly.
Nice. Yeah, and that's, I think we all kind of look for ways to kind of keep things interesting every day now. So yeah.
And are you still, I know that you're from south of London. Do you still live there? Or do you live in the London area now, David?
Yeah, that's right. So I've moved about a bit. I grew up in a place called Sussex, so right on the southeast coast of England, right by the sea. And then I went to university in Wales. So I lived in Wales for 5 years. Then I moved to London for a year or two. And yeah, I'm back now in Sussex, actually. It's hard to justify living in London, unfortunately, because especially if you're a chess player, kind of traveling around the world half a year, then it's hard to justify the rent. So
Yeah, as a former freelance New York resident, I can definitely relate to that.
No, exactly. And I don't know.
It's fun, but tough to pull off.
Yeah, that's right. City life is mixed blessings as well.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, what was the name of your town? I looked it up.
Seaford or Seaford?
Yeah, Seaford. It looked beautiful in the pictures.
Okay. I'm impressed you've done your research. Yeah.
I didn't stalk your house. I didn't Google search your house or anything, but yeah. I did check out the town.
Okay. For everyone who wants to know, I live at number 40.
Right.
No, but yeah, it's a nice place. Yes. I mean, I live 5 minutes walk from the sea, and there's some cliff tops that are quite famous, the Seven Sisters, which are just a short drive away. And yeah, I mean, it's nice. It's a nice place to relax between the kind of madness of tournaments.
Yeah, which you're getting a lot of relaxation time now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of itching to get started again. But
yeah, I bet. So you, in your banter blitzes, you've been nice enough to answer a lot of questions. And you made it sound like you're having periods of motivation and periods of no motivation during this quarantine.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure it's the same for you, for everyone right now. Yeah, I mean, I think I go through different phases in my life as well. But yeah, at the moment, I'm kind of on top of things. I feel kind of I've finally got my life in order. It's been nice to have some downtime. I finally caught up with all my admin that's been building up for the last year or two. I'm finally, trying to start getting fit and things. But yeah, there are days when it's just hard to kind of even get changed, you know. Get the motivation to even brush the teeth and that stuff. So,
yeah,
I
hear you.
I'm half joking at least.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, I mean, obviously I've been a fan of your chess for a long time and been aware of you as a top level chess player, but up until the past, say, few months, I knew you best for basically photo bombing or making brief appearances in Fiona Steele Anthony's vlogs.
Oh dear. Not my finest moments, sorry.
You would always be in there making goofy faces, but then it was like I never actually heard you talk. And then suddenly it's like a switch flipped and you're everywhere. So was this a conscious decision, David?
I think so, in a way. I realize I'm getting old. I can't just focus on playing chess and I can't get away. I mean, I'm too old to get away with photo bombing people's photos and just trolling people all the time. So I thought it's time to start building a career and being a bit more serious. Yeah, I just hope people aren't sick of my voice by now with all these banter blitzes and the other things that are going on. And now,
no, I don't think so. As Tarjei Svensson's been saying on Twitter, you're a natural at the banner blitzes.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I've spent the last 20 years playing online blitz. I thought I might as well start talking about them, about the games and things as I went along.
Yeah, and the banter blitzes are one of the many topics covered in this DVD. 15 hours, topics like about me, calculation, converting end games, time pressure, maximizing, opening prep. And there's like 10 more. I'm not even going to list them all. Yeah. But I mean, it's impressively comprehensive. So could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this project with the Ginger GM production company?
Yeah, sure. So so a couple of years ago now, I was just talking to Simon Williams, the Ginger GM himself. He, I mean, we've been good friends for a long time. We've been playing on the same British team. And I mean, he's extremely well known in the UK, I guess all around the world for his streaming, his videos. He works a lot with chess.com. He's kind of one of the most charismatic chess players on the British scene, at least. And he has quite an interesting view on chess and how chess should be taught and how to make it exciting for people. And yeah, he said he wanted to get me involved with the project. He wasn't so keen on, I don't think either of us were too keen on kind of just doing a straightforward opening video or opening DVD, maybe somewhere down the line. But yeah, he thought, well, I mean, we've been playing each other again for 20 or odd years, and he's seen me progress through the ranks. And he said it would be nice to hear, well, nice for me to talk about my journey in a way. And I'm pretty much self-taught from the age of about 11 or 12 onwards. I had a lot of coaching when I was up to that age. But after that, I thought, okay, it's time to try and figure out this game all by myself. And yeah, I've learned a few things along the way. So this was just a chance for me to tell some stories, to show how I work on chess, and hopefully some of those tips might help the viewers pick up a few rating points along the way. So yeah, it was just nice to get the opportunity to talk about all these different topics. We figured, okay, it might end up being quite a long course, but if I was able to touch on as many subjects as possible, I think in most chess DVDs, even some chess, even chess literature, that not many sources talk about things like, you know, the practical things like how to deal with time trouble, because sometimes it is unavoidable, unfortunately. And and everyone has their own different ways of learning. And if mine resonates with other people, then that's just a bonus. So, yeah, hopefully everyone does enjoy it.
Yeah, as I said, I picked it up. I mean, being that it's 15 hours and we just nailed down this interview about a week ago, I have to confess, David, I've only watched about half of it so far.
I mean, that's still impressive.
Yeah, no, it's a testament to how much I've enjoyed it. It's a pleasure to watch, and the chapters are pretty short. So, you know, it's like you just, for me, that makes it more manageable because I'll have 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there. But because of my family obligations, I'm not sitting around for like huge chunks of free time, you know. Nice. But I mean, it's, as you say, it's really good, and it covers a lot of different topics. And you allude to being self-taught, which I know is a lot of our listeners are adult chess enthusiasts who are self-taught. And I was also impressed with sort of the perspective you have for who your audience is as a super GM. So was that hard for you to sort of put yourself in the shoes of someone who, you know, was not beating John Nunn when they were 8 years old, and, you know, someone who has not been studying chess, like treating it as a career for, you know, close to 20 years?
Yeah. I mean, it was hard at times, maybe. I mean, again, I've been quite lucky. I've done a fair amount of teaching in my time. And a lot of my closest friends, actually, they are kind of part-time chess players. They do have full-time jobs and things. And when I analyze things with them, I mean, it's not actually bringing myself down any level, I don't think. It's just, I don't know, it's just empathizing with someone and realizing that, I mean, chess can't unfortunately be a full-time thing for most people. And we all have our different ways of dealing with things, of discussing chess, of learning. So, yeah, somehow it's never really, well, I've never been told that I kind of go too deep on things. So, and yeah, my approach to chess is keeping things simple anyway. And if that helps with the majority of viewers, then yeah, that's hopefully a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of, so you mentioned a couple coaches that you had in your earliest years as a chess player in the DVD, Glenn Fleer, and there was another one, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the coach that had the greatest impact on me when I was very young, I think from the age of maybe 7 till 10, was actually a local player called Jonathan Tuck. And I mean, he doesn't have a title. He barely plays competitively. Even in those days, he'd kind of semi-retired. But I guess he's around 2,200 strength. He was really kind in the early days. I mean, I'm not from a very wealthy family, and he would often give lessons. I mean, he would go over and above, really. He'd give lessons sometimes for free. He'd travel to tournaments, and he'd travel to tournaments with me, even if we kind of couldn't afford to always pay him his full amount. And he instilled this love of the game within me. I mean, he gave me chess books. He kind of pointed me in the right direction of, you know, what I should be studying and how to keep it fun at all times. And yeah, we still keep in touch. He runs kind of junior chess now in the area that I'm from, Sussex Junior Chess. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this county has produced many of the youngsters who play for the England national team and who end up coming back to the game in later years because, he instills that love of chess in. So
now you're doing some work with those kids as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. You've definitely done your homework. I am technically the president of Sussex Junior Chess, but I used to be more of a figurehead. But recently, I've been going along to some training days, and I'm actually running an online team right now. There's a British league. I think there's 170 teams playing or something, and I'm running a junior team. The average age is 10. And a couple of them are from this local area. And yeah, I'm just trying to do it all pro bono during this lockdown just to try and help give them a boost.
That's awesome. I mean, it's nice how someone like your youth coach can set the example, and now you can sort of pay it forward.
Yeah, I'm sure all the viewers out there probably have some instance of an early memory in chess as well, of someone who kind of gave them that motivation and shared their love of the game with them.
Yeah. So you've got some great stories in your DVD. And of course, we know from the the story I already alluded to of you beating John Nunn in a blitz game when you were eight, which you cover very early in the DVD. So from that, I guess one could infer, and from your youth titles, that you had success pretty quickly once you started playing chess.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it all kind of happened so quickly, and yeah, it feels like a lifetime ago now. But yeah, I guess the first time I really realized that maybe I could pursue chess properly was when I beat John Nunn when I was eight. I mean, I did win some youth titles, but I mean, it's hard to judge, it's hard to have perspective when you're that young. And suddenly, I mean, all my friends used to tease me about it. I was in the newspapers and all this stuff because of that result. And yeah, it was then when I really started thinking, okay, let's give this chess thing a go. I do enjoy it. I mostly enjoyed the winning at that point, but and yeah, I guess up until my early teens, I mean, I think everyone goes through a rocky patch. And yeah, I mean, I had all these exams at school and I was feeling the pressure. So I stopped playing chess for a year or so, a year and a half, maybe when I was 14. I think I had 2 Grandmaster Norms and almost the rating. And then I just stopped playing chess because life does get in the way sometimes and so on. But yeah, I guess I started when I was young. And it took me a long time after that, though, to kind of fully focus and fully realize I had to put in the hard work to keep up with my peers. And yeah, I'm from this. I think I do mention it on the DVD as well, that I'm from this 1990 group with Magnus Carlsen, Maxime Vacher-Legras, Sergei Karjakin, Jan Nepomniachtchi. So it's kind of keeps myself grounded. I look at these guys and think, okay, they went far, far and above. But hopefully on my day, I can still compete with them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're in the same conversation for sure, which is more than most of us can say. And yeah, I was really struck by that. That's crazy that you guys were all born in the same year. So being a top youth player, I guess, did you encounter them regularly as the years went on?
Yeah, I still think of Magnus as an 8-year-old, you know. yeah, I mean, I think there was one crazy under 10 tournament where all of us guys were playing and we all ended up in the top 10. And now you look at us on the rating list and we're all, well, those guys are definitely up there. I'm slightly behind, but yeah, and we kept encountering each other. I think in the World Under 12 Championship in the final round, I stopped Magnus from winning the gold medal and he didn't talk to me for a few years.
Wow.
For like 7 years, but now we're good friends. And I think there's a mutual respect there because we did. I mean, I don't think any of us would be as good as we are now if we didn't have each other pushing all the way. We kind of drag each other to become stronger. So, yeah.
So did you beat him or draw him in that game that stopped him?
I drew. Unfortunately, I've beaten him in some blitz games, some friendly blitz games, but never in a formal game, unfortunately. I think 4 draws and 2 losses.
I'd take it.
Well, yeah. I had him on the ropes though a couple of times and I might have missed my shot, but oh well.
Yeah. So you mentioned you're a strong young player. I tried to track down, you know, FIDE of course has their old top 100 list, but I couldn't find an old top junior list like you guys in your prime. So where did you all fall on the rating spectrum before Magnus kind of pulled ahead? I mean, I know Karjakin was obviously breaking records.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he was GM at a crazy young age, right? 12, I think. And
Yeah.
I think I remember when I was maybe 11, playing in this World Under 12 Championship. At the time, I was about 22-50. Magnus was maybe 22-70. And then 1 year later, he was about 2500 and I was about the same rating still. So I think it was around those ages, 13, 14, 15, that the really top players, they did start to pull ahead and the rest of us had to try and play catch up. It's kind of like the situation you see now in India with these kind of Pragnananda, Nihar Sarin, Gukesh. They're kind of 25, 2600 now. They're what, 14 years old. So that's the age that they start accelerating, I think.
And we'll get back to what happened in those years because you already mentioned it just now and you allude to it in the DVD as well, but mm-hmm. I did want to throw in a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast. So
cool.
Question is from Jeff Anderson, who mentions the famous game against John Nunn where you beat him in a blitz game. And he says, based on this, he says, you obviously have innate talent for the game. When you calculate a tactical sequence, what do you see in your imagination?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, these days it tends to be a bit more structured. I remember when I was maybe that age, when I was playing John Nunn, when I was eight, even when I was in my late teens, I think it was all a bit of a blur. It would just be kind of whatever move came to my mind first, I'd start calculating that one. Sometimes I'd struggle to retrace my steps back to square one. And that would mean that occasionally I could miss things early in the variation, but I would normally be quite good at calculating long, sharp lines if there weren't too many offshoots, if there weren't too many sidelines along the way. These days, I work a lot on calculation. I actually gave a training camp just a few days ago to a group of American kids, and I was talking about calculation there. I've been told it's one of my strongest points, and that's only because of practice, though. And now I structure it. I kind of do the whole candidate move things and kind of breaking things down chunk by chunk. And often you can calculate by process of elimination, but it does take a lot of self-awareness to be able to structure your thoughts during games. So, I mean, the way I recommend to study is maybe going through endgame studies, for example, Dovretsky, that kind of thing. It really helps in the endgame, but also in the middle game, just that kind of just that awareness to structure your thoughts. And that's so important with calculation. I think top players are so quick at calculating just because they've practiced structuring their thoughts so quickly. And it comes back to basics. We're all taught this when we're young, looking at the checks first, captures first, threats first. Those kind of things. But the more you practice those things, the quicker the calculation becomes. So nowadays it's slightly more organized, but in the past it definitely used to be a bit of a blur.
Okay, yeah. And you walk through some calculation and a study or two in the DVD, which is quite helpful. So I want to ask you both how you work on your calculation now and how you worked on it when you were an up-and-coming player once you started to be more self-taught. You just touched on it, but mm-hmm. What was your, like, how much were you studying and where were you getting the resources as a kid, first of all?
Yeah, so I guess I was very lucky. I mean, my father, he was obsessed with books. I kind of grew up in a room. There were bookshelves on three walls, and that meant that he was happy to buy in as many chess books as possible. I mean, when I was really young, and kind of computers were kind of still in their infancy, and they still weren't so strong, and there weren't many online resources in those days. So I mostly learned from books and playing through positions. With my earliest coaches, for example, Jonathan Tuck I mentioned and Glenn Fleer, they would sit me down with a couple of positions and they'd force me to calculate sometimes variations up to 5-10 moves just with a board in front of me, and I wouldn't be allowed to touch the pieces. And I mean, that really helped my visualization. In later days, I tried to keep doing that. Nowadays players do this kind of puzzle rush on chess.com, and they do these kind of short, sharp things just to keep their minds fresh with tactics. But I think with calculation in general, it helps to just sit there with a board, imagine it's a game situation, and just force yourself to practice those trains of thoughts that you would have during a game. I definitely think that with those endgame studies, for example, I started picking those up when I was maybe in my late teens, and I'd force myself to sit there and try and work things out, make sure I definitely hadn't missed any resources, defensive resources along the way for the opponents. Or it's hard work, and it takes a lot of discipline not to move the pieces about or not to just kind of go online and do this short superficial calculation stuff. If you structure it slowly, then it definitely has its benefits later on when you do sit at the board.
Yeah, definitely in the easier said than done category.
No, definitely. That's the hardest part of chess to work on, actually, the calculation, I think, but it's the part that pays off the most.
Oh, great advice. And if you are doing one of these studies and you're not finding the answer, like, are you ever giving up, or do you just keep trying no matter what?
Yeah, I'm a stubborn so-and-so, so I try to keep going. But I find the best way, for all the listeners out there, I think the best way is to have a sparring partner to push each other, to test each other. I mean, right now it's hard to get one of those over the board. But I mean, for example, online, there's so many players that maybe if you find someone of a similar level with a similar kind of interest in chess, and you can set each other puzzles, try and push each other to solve them, and stay motivated when you're unable to find the answer. And I think that's the best way in general to improve.
What's the longest you've ever spent on like one study? Can you think of any?
Earlier this year, you mentioned Gibraltar. So I was commentating there, and one evening, a friend, we didn't have a board. We were just at dinner, and a friend told me this, asked me to set up this position in my head, and it literally took me days to solve it. And I was going mad by the end of the tournament. During the commentary, sometimes I'd lose my train of thought just because I was thinking about the position. I eventually got the answer, but yeah, even then, you know, it took hours to keep going back in my head and making sure that I hadn't missed any.
Do you mind saying who it was?
So it's actually a Romanian woman player called Irina Bulmaga.
And I
was in a group, actually. You mentioned Fiona, her partner Alex. We were all kind of sitting in a group. We were having a drink after a long day, and yeah, we were just discussing chess and life and stuff. And suddenly, I don't know how it turned to impossible chess problems, but she gave me this position, and yeah, it was.
Would you be willing to send me the position for me to put in the show notes?
Yeah, sure. I'll do that after the show, for sure.
I want to be clear. I'm not going to try it. I know.
Maybe with a pod it's easier, but I was told I had to do it in my head. And,
Okay, but I mean, that shows the hard work and the obsessiveness necessary to reach your level.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing we have in common. Unfortunately, we are quite obsessive, no matter what we turn our minds to.
And were you like that as a kid, like studying on your own? Once, were you just bitten by the bug and obsessed from a young age?
I guess. Although, I mean, I'd like to think I was quite well balanced. But yeah, there are times when I was obsessed, and I would just play as much as I could. I mean, as soon as I discovered things like the Internet Chess Club and PlayChess.com, I used to play Blitz for hours on end. But no matter what I did, I tried to make sure it was quite structured. Along the way, I'd always make notes, you know, in the Blitz games, if an opening problem came up or if there was a pattern of why I'd lose. But it's obsessive, I think, is the right word. No matter what I do, I mean, I used to be obsessed with football, with tennis, all these things, and a bit like Magnus, you see with his fantasy football. You know, once we turn our minds to something, we have to push it the whole way.
And did you play them, football and tennis, or more as a fan?
Yeah, I used to play them all the time, especially football. It was literally an everyday thing for me at school, and kick about afterwards, at the weekends with my friends, everything. But unfortunately these days, yeah, no time, and slightly older, less fit, all that stuff.
Don't give up, David. What are you, 20, 29, 30? 20, how old?
29, yeah. I'm 30 later this year, so I'm trying to make the most of my energy while it lasts.
Sounds like you're having a tough time with this 30th birthday.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I've been chatting online with some of my friends during this lockdown, and they're all kind of on the video calls. They all bring out their babies halfway through, and I'm just sitting here thinking, what have I done with my life?
Enjoy your freedom while you can.
Yeah, sorry, Ben. I'm sure the family, though, it's definitely worth it.
No, yeah, it's very gratifying, but yeah, it's You still have some green in front of you. You'll be okay.
Hopefully. I'm hoping for a second wind at some point, just to guide me through.
So if we could trace your path forward just a little bit, David, you mentioned so you've alluded to a sort of period of burnout. I mean, first of all, you've talked. In your Wikipedia page, they talk about you having all these kind of television opportunities, and you mentioned you got a lot of attention after you announced your arrival on the chess scene, and you know, having this podcast, I know that there's so many enthusiastic British chess fans, and there's such a rich chess history. Shout out to Great Britain.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what it was like and how you managed feeling sort of expectations as you continued to progress?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head completely. It was the expectations that I think got on top of me. I remember, I've gone through maybe a couple of stages of burnout in my career, and one of them was kind of triggered by... kind of a very respected chess journalist in the UK. I won't go into names right now, but he wrote a very kind of damning report about me on one of these English chess forums, and that really got to me emotionally. I mean, I thought I was doing okay. I was really enjoying my chess, and suddenly, I mean, he wrote things. He was implying I'd let the country down by not progressing at the same rate as some of my peers, and things like that. And when you're an emotional teenager, that kind of thing does affect you. I think. Yeah, I mean, I've always been in love with the game. In a way, it's just, yeah, some of the expectation that comes around it. And especially if you don't surround yourself with the right people and, you know, if at a certain time. I mean, I know in my teens, there were a lot of people pushing me in different directions. And I think it was just nice to take a step back. Sure everyone's had that in their career sometimes when other stuff's going on in life, your head isn't completely clear. And if you just take a few months off and come back to it a bit later, then often that just, you just remember the good stuff. And hopefully all the negative influences, you're able to get rid of those because it took me a long time. But luckily, in the end, I was able to move past all the media stuff or the expectations or the negativity.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun for a teenager to deal with.
Yeah, even now I'm a bit bitter, but luckily I've kind of put it out of my mind mostly.
Yeah, well, sorry to dredge it up.
That's cool.
So how much time did you take away in your early teen years?
Yeah, so when I was about 14, I think I played a lot until I was 14, just almost every weekend when I could. My school were very kind. They let me take time off. But when I was around 14, in England, we have these exams called GCSEs. Normally, they're taken at the age of 16. But just to add to the pressure, I was a year ahead at school. So I was doing them when I was 14, 15. And I think building up to those, my school put a lot of pressure on me to kind of get my head back in the game and refocus. And that's when I took about a year and a half. I was barely playing any chess, but then I came back. I managed to get my grandmaster title at 16, and then after that I took a year before well I took 2 years out actually before university to play a lot of chess as much as I could. But then it was mixed feelings. I saw all my friends at university having a great time, telling me how amazing life was, and I thought I wanted that life experience as well. So I think at the age of 19 I went to university, and then from then on I only played maybe one or two tournaments a year. So I still played a bit, but far less active, and I didn't keep up with the chess study as much as I should have done.
Do you have regrets, or are you happy with it was, as you say, pulled in both directions. I mean, it had to be hard to choose in either way.
No, that's right. I mean, yeah, again, it's I know I'm indecisive in terms of my life and career choices. I've always kind of, I think until the last couple of years actually, I've always been thinking, you know, should I really pursue this chess thing for the rest of my life, or should I have a backup plan? And I'm sure a lot of listeners out there have that as well, with a couple of things in their lives. And I guess it took me a while to overcome, I'm still not sure whether I made the right decision. There are days when I look at Magnus and that lot and I think, you know, if I hadn't given them 4 or 5 years head start on me, then maybe I'd be up there competing with them a bit more often. So mixed feelings, but in general I loved my time at university so much, and again it taught me to be a bit more structured with my thinking, and it forced me to, I studied English literature and philosophy at university. It forced me to do a bit more reading, kind of self-introspection and that all that stuff. So I'm grateful for the experience, and I met some of my best friends along the way, which is a bonus.
So you mentioned some, it sounds like maybe to the extent that you have any regret, it's that maybe you didn't, that you took a break and didn't push quite as hard as you could have in chess. Do you ever have regrets in the other direction? Like, oh my God, I spent so much time on chess. You know, I could have been a nuclear physicist or something. Like, does your regret go in both ways, or just that maybe you could have tried to keep up with Magnus?
It definitely goes both ways. I mean with the chess, actually the time I had the biggest regrets was I think immediately after I finished university I came back to chess, and my openings were just terrible. I'd kind of not kept up with opening theory for the previous 2-3 years, and took a long time to get back with that. I mean, in the other direction though, there are days when I think, you know, I could have been a Premier League footballer if I'd if I hadn't been away every weekend playing chess.
Were you that good at football?
No, I probably like a Sunday league footballer, you know.
Okay, I mean, that's still obviously excellent.
No, I definitely everyone thinks they could have been something, but no, I don't think that was ever on the cards for me. I would love to pursue academia a bit more in future. I've always had this pipe dream of being a writer of like historical fiction, But yeah, I think that's some way down the line for me again.
Okay. I mean, David, you're still young, but exactly. The chess world is happy to have you. So
no, thanks, Ben. Yeah. I definitely need that reassurance once in a while.
And I think Great Britain in particular, I gather, as I said, very, very passionate chess fans. And I did just as a chess journalist, I in hearing you talk about it, I wanted to seek your counsel a bit because, you know, I often get emails asking for a particular guest. And whenever they're sort of in their early teens, I'm always slightly hesitant. You know, I mean, I try generally to be fair to my guests and to be supportive. Yeah. But on the other hand, sometimes I wonder if attention itself can be corrosive at times to strong young players. From your experience, what's your opinion? Is it like, what's the proper treatment for young, talented chess players?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, first of all, I would have been a terrible guest when I was in my early teens. You know, I would have been very monosyllabic and I wouldn't have been able to get some proper answers out. But I lean towards kind of sheltering them as much as possible, kind of minimizing any expectations on their shoulders. I know there are a few chess players now, for example, Nihal Sarin, who gets a lot of media attention, and Firuzia and that lot. But I do think they have great kind of, they have great parents helping them along the way, and they have a lot of kind of people dealing with the social media for them, helping them kind of manage all of the stuff that comes along with being one of the kind of hottest young prospects in the world. So, and you see Magnus Carlsen, I mean, he had his dad, he has his manager, they've been with him every step of the journey, just kind of helping him minimize his kind of duties, his burdens. And it's a tricky balancing act. In general, I would, especially in England, I would try not to put too much pressure on people's shoulders at too young an age. It can definitely go to the head or kind of weigh you down. And as the hottest young prospects, they need to be well managed. But yeah, I think if they're lucky, if they do have some great role models around them, then they can definitely still go far. I do just regret maybe letting it get to me a bit too much and maybe not talking about how much it was getting to me along the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard though. You're a kid, you know?
Exactly. It's hard to communicate. It's hard to deal with everything. That's right.
Yeah, and your point about like you would have been a terrible interview, like that's something that I wasn't a prodigy to begin with, but I would have been a terrible interview too. So I mean, like I often, that also sort of points me in the direction of giving people space, you know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, people do, you know, young talents are fascinating, you know. People want to know how their minds work, so there's always an interest, but there's also like you say, people need space.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd love to actually hear more from some of these young players because I think they train now in a completely different way to the way I trained when I was younger. I mean, I think most of their stuff, Nihal Sarin, I think he plays like 5 hours online every day. Firuzia is just only plays online every day pretty much. And I'm just fascinated that they can get to such a high level just purely by working with computers and technology. And yeah, for me, that's mind-boggling. But yeah, I guess I'll ask them when they're a bit older. And,
Okay, so David, we're going to take a quick break hear from Chessable. Two important aspects of chess improvement that Grandmaster David Howell highlights are the importance of calculation and of knowing the classics. On Chessable, you can work on both of these skills at once by studying Chess Calculation Training 3, Legendary Games by GM Romain Edouard. This is an awesome book for fairly advanced players with over 480 exercises, and it has chapters devoted exclusively to Kasparov, Kramnik, Fischer, and Karpov. Of course, it has Chessable's Move Trainer technology to help you remember the patterns you learn. So go to chessable.com and have a look. So David, another, of course, favorite part of mine from the DVD, the story of the training session with Kasparov. So just incredible stuff. I don't know how much you want to reveal of this gold material that can be purchased for a modest price, but could you tell the story a little bit about what it was like and the circumstances under which you got to play these training games with the legend himself?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it still feels a bit surreal. it was a few years ago. So it was in 2017 and I was living in London at the time and I think I was teaching that day. I was rushing about, or I was meeting some friends, and I got back afterwards and I saw I had a missed call. I had a voicemail on my phone, and I listened to it, and it was this, it's like, I mean, I'm not going to do an impression, but it was a rather deep voice, you know, saying, David, what are you doing next week? Would you like to come to Croatia? And we got in touch, and Gary invited me out to his place out in Croatia. And I was actually due to play a different tournament, and my mum and sister were supposed to come along with me, just a family holiday. And I mean, he was nice enough to asked them to come along with me to Croatia, and he covered it all. And I mean, that's so nice of him. But yeah, the idea was to play a training match. Gary was making a comeback in St. Louis in a rapid and blitz tournament. And I think he just wanted a sparring partner. Probably he just wanted someone he could crush, you know, just a bit of an ego boost. And I think he wanted to try out some opening ideas and maybe discuss a few things along the way. And yeah, it was surreal. We played 27 games. He did beat me by a few points in the end. But yeah, it was just incredible just to see his intensity and to get to play someone I regard as the greatest chess player of all time. We were playing on a balcony with the beach right there, and Gary was in shorts and a t-shirt, and yeah, it all feels like a dream. And I think definitely the first few games I was in awe. Like, I lost a couple of rapid games at the beginning just because I thought, oh my god, I'm sitting here with Garry Kasparov. And I managed to warm up towards the end and test him a bit more, and I got a few victories under my belt. But yeah, it was, I mean, lifelong dream that I didn't even know I had. And
you can see a couple of the games in the DVD, which is a treat in itself.
That's right. So
what's, I mean, I have so many questions from this. Number one, did you even know he had your phone number?
No, but I've had some stranger people call me in the past, let's just say. So,
oh wow. Now forget Kasparov, let's hear about that.
No comment, but yeah, I mean, I think he got it through a mutual friend, so I was a bit surprised, of course. But yeah, I mean, if Garry Kasparov calls you up, then yeah, it's definitely an honor, it's definitely flattering. And that was a shock.
Yeah, and like I say, you cover the chess in the DVD, which is, mm-hmm. is super fun to see. But so he never sort of, you mentioned you don't really know how you were chosen. Did you have many casual conversations with him? Were you guys having drinks at night? Like, what happened when you weren't doing chess while you were there?
Yeah, so we had dinner a couple of times together. Actually, he's got a very strict routine. Even now, after the games in the evenings, his mother would often interrupt our analysis session saying, okay, it's time for Gary's walk. And he'd go for a walk or a jog every evening for an hour or two. And we did have some time to discuss the chess. Actually, because we were playing blitz and rapid, often we would spend some time afterwards just reconstructing the games, making sure we had them in our notes, and especially the openings we would discuss as well. Because I think that was the part of his game, the openings, that he was most worried about. I mean, having been retired for 12, 13 years at that point. So he was definitely worried about the openings, and his calculation was still sharp as anything. He was out calculating me. He was quicker than me. It was very impressive for someone who hadn't played for so long. Actually, most of our discussions revolved around politics and AI and things outside of the chess. But yeah, it was just nice to see him in a chilled out mood, which I hadn't seen before.
So did he have any requests with openings, or was it just he just wanted to see what you brought and go from there?
Yeah, I don't think he had any specific requests. I mean, I think he hinted a couple of times that it would be nice if I mixed things up to try kind of different things against him, just so he could maybe try out all of his ideas, or he could make sure he didn't have any kind of gaps that he hadn't prepared. So I played a lot of different things. For example, if he played e4, I played the Caro-Kann, the French, the Sicilian. 1e45 with black. I played the Nimzo, the Grunfeld a couple of times just to try and test him. But he didn't specifically request for that. I just thought it would be nice for him to try his hand in a few different areas. I don't think he was too intense about those things. But one thing that impressed me was that he'd done a lot of preparation. I thought, okay, training match, just friendly, he will just turn up and And then afterwards, he was telling me all these holes he'd found in my repertoire. And, and I mean, he clearly spent tens of hours, probably more actually, just looking at my games. And yeah, he was ready for everything. I thought I had some tricky blitz lines. And he was like, oh yeah, I noticed you played this in some blitz game a few years ago. And yeah, it was impressive. Just that, yeah, intensity and the kind of the attention to detail.
And with him being, you mentioned he was still able to out-calculate you. Did you get a sense from chatting with him, like, is that something that he still works on, or is it just like always there for him?
Yeah, I think he works on it a bit, but not full time. I think he goes, I mean, he'll have maybe a, I mean, he's such a busy guy, of course, but he will have maybe a week downtime, and he often uses that to follow chess or train a bit and try and keep himself fresh. I mean, he still plays a few exhibition events from time to time, so maybe that's the only training he does. I think his opening's still relatively sharp, but he has a lot of ideas from the past that he's trying to bring back or recycle, I think, in these events. So I think if he does any work on chess, then it probably is on keeping sharp and calculation, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah, not especially probably with everyone else having engines, you know, superpower engines these days, it's you know, the Evans Gambit and stuff might have some trouble.
No, exactly. He didn't punt the Evans Gambit or the King's Gambit against me, unfortunately. But yeah, he's still super sharp. It was incredible.
And I mean, I'm sure you've got so many stories, but just a few that I jotted down, aside from the Kasparov thing, which obviously I could hear you talk about for hours. But you also you mentioned that you helped Peter Svidler before the 2016 candidates.
Yeah, that's right. That was my first real experience as part of a big team for such an important event. And again, that's one of my chess heroes. I've been playing the Grünfeld since I was 6 years old. And to get to work with one of the biggest, I mean, okay, Peter Svidler, biggest Grünfeld expert of his time. And to get to work with someone whose games you've played through since the age of six, that was incredible. And again, that came about quite randomly. We just got talking after a couple of tournaments and we got on quite well. And I mean, he's a bit of an Anglophile. I think he liked the fact that he could discuss cricket with me or something.
Right, yeah.
And then he found out I had no cricket knowledge, and he told me the only preparation to do for the camp was to book up on my cricket. So yeah, that was again an incredible experience. I was very much designated a couple of specific openings and specific variations to focus on. I mean, actually, a couple of them came up in the match. There was one position that we had on the analysis board, I think on move, it came up in his first round game. In we got to move 27 as black, and he had a winning advantage. So
well,
I was especially,
well done.
No, thank you. I was especially proud of that one. But yeah, I still feel like it would have helped more. I was still quite inexperienced as kind of second as an openings researcher, that kind of thing. But so maybe I could do a better job these days. But yeah, I'm grateful for the experience, and he's, I mean, he lives up to his reputation, one of the nicest guys in chess. And again, incredible, I think, innate talent. He's definitely one of the top ones up there.
And so you would be, would you be interested in doing something like that again if an opportunity arose?
Yeah, I mean, if Magnus or Fabiano or someone, if you're listening, then yeah, give me a shout. I'll give you mates rates. Yeah.
Excellent. I haven't heard that term. And I, now that I'm thinking about the candidates, I can't help but ask you what your overall impression of this year's candidates so far was.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to think, really. I mean, I was a bit surprised that they went ahead and started it. I mean, I think everyone sympathizes with Radjabov to an extent. But yeah, I mean, I thought the quality of chess was quite high for the most part. It was interesting. It was nice to see these ideas with everyone pushing the h-pawn in every game, these alpha zero ideas come to the fore. And yeah, I thought the players dealt with the whole situation admirably, considering that I'm not sure whether Fabiano even got home eventually, or I think all of the players were, yeah, caught in two minds about playing. And yeah, I was lucky enough to be on the commentary with Chess24 for the last day or two as well. I think the last round, Magnus was commentating in that, and yeah, he was saying he was pretty impressed as well. And then suddenly the tournament stopped when I was supposed to commentate again. So yeah, I was gutted that it did end, because it kept us all busy, kept us all entertained. But in general, I thought, yeah, I can't really fault FIDE, I think, for going ahead with it. They tried something, it didn't quite work. And yeah, I can't wait for the second half later in the year, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Or next year.
We'll see. And so you got to commentate a bit on that for Chess24. You did a great job in Gibraltar. So are you enjoying that aspect of your foray into chess media?
No, I think I am. I think so. It's still early days. I think the most part is that the viewers don't get sick of me, or they don't wish, replace that guy with Peter Svidler or something. And, no, I've been enjoying it so far. Luckily, I mean, you mentioned Gibraltar. It's been my favorite tournament. I've been there 15 times, I think. I've played maybe 11, 12 times. But it was a big decision to commentate rather than play, because actually in terms of prize money, the most amounts I've ever won are all from Gibraltar. So that was a big decision. But luckily, yeah, I had a great team around me. Fiona Steele Anthony was there to kind of guide me through it and give me pep talks when I got too nervous or got too tongue-tied. So that was a great learning experience. And things like Chess24, I mean, the future of chess is all online. And that was just great to be invited along to those things as well. I'm still finding my feet, so hopefully listeners can bear with me in the time being.
No, you're a natural. And do you have with doing some chess training, obviously you're still a competitor as well. Mm-hmm. With broadcasting and now you're writing as well. Do you mm-hmm. have a favorite amongst the things you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm still a player at heart for now. But again, that goes through phases. You go through rough patches. I think I'm still recovering from this Isle of Man tournament last year emotionally, just one game away from getting into the candidates myself. That would have been, the end of a long, long journey. I mean, a dream, a lifelong dream. But I still I feel I have a lot of unfinished business with the playing. It took me a while to get back to my best, but yeah, still some stuff to do with my playing career. But I do enjoy the writing a lot. I've been writing for the Sunday Times now for nearly three years, and the Times just taken over recently. And I feel there are far better writers out there than me, but I'm enjoying it and I'm learning, and hopefully the stuff I'm writing is interesting at least for everyone. The commentary, yeah, I enjoy that too, but I don't think I could do that full time yet. It's just... Yeah, I'll run out of things to say eventually.
Yeah, you gotta watch more shows like Jan Gustafsson.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, when in doubt, he always ends up talking about Breaking Bad or some basketball thing. Yeah, right. I definitely need more reference points before I can head into that one.
And you mentioned your near miss for making the candidates. Sorry to sort of drill in on a sore subject, but
it's okay.
But I mean, I would love to hear you sort of go behind the scenes of what it felt like going into the last round, and what ended up happening.
I mean, I think you've chosen a good time. I'm finally getting over it, so so it was a bit surreal. I mean, halfway through the tournament, I remember on the rest day, so after six of the 11 rounds, I think I was on only plus one. So I was on 3.5 out of 6. I'd lost a couple of games. I lost my first round even. And I had no expectations. I knew only one person qualifies. I mean, Carlsen's playing, Caruana's playing, Aronian's playing, all these guys. So I just killed all my expectations there. On the rest day, I played football with Magnus and a few others. I remember I was chatting with Fiona. We actually did a stream on the rest day, and with Simon Williams, the Ginger GM, and they were saying, come on, you can do this. You can win some games in the second half. And I just remember thinking, okay, they're just teasing me now. They're just mocking me. So I had zero expectations. And then suddenly I started winning in the second half. I mean, I managed to beat Kazim Janov, former FIDE world champion, and Alexander Grishuk. And I found myself in this last round game against Wang Hao with black, knowing that a win would give me great chances of qualifying. I was just trying to treat every game as it came. And I had this routine. I wouldn't check the pairings the night before the game. I'd only check in the morning when I woke up so that, I could sleep peacefully and everything. And apart from the fact that the last round was a morning game, I remember the last thing I did before I went to bed was I checked my email because I had a newspaper deadline. And a friend of mine had messaged me. He said, good luck against Wang Hao. And that whole night, I just I couldn't sleep.
So basically, it's all your friend's fault.
Exactly. I haven't even told him because I don't want to kind of taint the friendship. But I definitely blame him. But yeah, I mean, it didn't help that Wang Hao has been a bit of a bogey player for me in the past, and also his approach to the game. So he had white. There was a huge bunch of us who kind of could have qualified if we'd won. I think there were maybe eight players. There were four matches where, you know, if someone won, they'd jump up and get first in the tournament and qualify. And I kind of assumed that my opponent, Wang Hao, would just go all out for the win. And yeah, in the end, I mean, he played probably the most unambitious opening I've ever seen him play. And he went straight for the draw. And I could tell from his body language, he was kind of waiting for the draw to happen on the board. And he was happy to swap everything off. And suddenly wasn't something I expected the night before. I was kind of prepping myself mentally for these scenarios where I had to gamble, I had to risk things. And I was sat there in the most dead drawn position ever. I mean, I still had to be accurate to make the draw, but I kind of saw a couple of paths to kind of the handshake. And I just sat there for 45 minutes at one point. I froze and I just got really depressed thinking, okay, I didn't even get a chance at achieving my dream of winning and qualifying for the candidates because he took my winning chances out right from the opening. And yeah, of course, it's never healthy to sit there and philosophize during a game. And I decided to sacrifice my queen for no good reason. I thought, okay, worst comes to worst, I'll probably have a fortress or something. But my thinking was all fuzzy and I didn't calculate. And actually, I was just one move away from getting that fortress. And the one trap I set, you know, my one winning hope, he saw it immediately. And of course, he refuted the whole concept. So actually, I blew a lot of money because I didn't want to go for the draw. And everyone gave me a bit of stick for self-destructing like that. I got some hate messages on Twitter from some Russian fans as well, who thought that I'd kind of thrown the game on purpose because my blunder was so elementary. But yeah, it was just an emotional day, really, and a bit of a blur. But hopefully I'll get another shot one day somewhere down
the line. Yeah. Like I said, 29, you're still young, David. But but thank you for being willing to talk about it. I mean, I'm sure
that's okay. I mean, it's probably all come out as a bit of a, you know, jumble there, but yeah, hopefully people can see the emotion that chess sometimes brings.
And you mentioned you feel like you're recovering. So what have you learned for any similar situations that you will doubtlessly face at some point?
Yeah. I mean, so I did a bit of research on you as well, and I know you used to play poker quite a lot. They talk about tilt in poker, and I mean, I think the main thing I learned from that game was just not go on tilt. I mean, okay, you're not always, I mean, even if you play a great game, sometimes you can't win if the opponent plays well as well. And I think there was nothing I could do in that game. Even if I'd drawn, okay, I would have made a bit more money, but I still wouldn't have qualified for the tournament. But the downside was that I did let it affect me in my next few events, and so I did go on tilt for a couple of months, and I undid, I think, 2-3 years of hard work gaining all my rating points. I undid that all in the space of two tournaments, pretty much. So I think what I've learned is definitely to be more aware of the tilt and to try and minimize its effects as quickly as possible, or at least to take a small break if I feel that things are kind of getting out of hand. I ended up losing 50 rating points in the space of two tournaments, pretty much. And it's a long way back from there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you guys do it to begin with. Competing at the level that you compete with when everyone's so prepared and so sharp. So
yeah, it's not easy. It's getting harder by the day as well.
Yeah, and were you okay, like mental health wise? I mean, did it like bleed over into your personal life and your sort of general outlook, or were you able to keep it compartmentalized? Excuse me, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I know. I think it did. Yeah, it did affect me definitely. I mean, I've struggled a bit with mental health things in the past. I think being self-employed, being on the road so much, being alone half the time, it does. I mean, chess is one of the trickiest lifestyles to kind of stay on top of things with. And I think until about 6 months ago, I never really discussed mental health with anyone really. But I was feeling really down for the next couple of months after that game. I think it was just a trigger rather than the sole cause. But luckily I do have some good friends that I can talk about things with. And I found it was healthy to kind of try and keep busy. I mean, hence all the media appearances, as you mentioned, and hence all the coaching. That's why I'm trying to stay fit as well. It's nice to kind of keep the mind occupied in a way. But yeah, it's just nice to surround yourself as well with positive influences. And that really helped drag me through that whole period in my life. So.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for being willing to talk about it.
That's okay.
And second of all, I'm glad to hear it. Sounds like you're doing a bit better. Definitely yeah. Something to stay on top of and check in with yourself. And as you say, exercise is good.
Yeah.
And third, you wouldn't know it from your appearances. You always seem to have a sunny disposition when you're public facing.
Yeah, maybe I should have been an actor. I don't know. But yeah. I think all of us at some point we go through ups and downs, and especially for those, chess players, we definitely need to be more aware of things like mental health. I think, and not be afraid to discuss it with people for sure.
Cool. All right, David, two more things if you're up for it.
Yeah, of course. Hit me.
All right. Excellent. So number one, I got your two stories about Kasparov and Svidler. I know you did a training session with Yusupov. Are there any other like crazy stories, whether they be brushes with chess legends? I know you've played basically everyone, or like brushes with celebrity, like outside of that?
Not sure, really. I've been very lucky. You're right. I've played most of the top guys now. Some of them I've played Drunken Blitz with, which has always been
nice.
Fun.
Who plays the best Drunken Blitz?
Mamedyarov, probably.
Now, he said at some point that he quit drinking.
I think I played him just before that.
Okay.
His teetotal phase. But yeah. Carlsen's still very good, even when he can barely... I shouldn't say this. even when he can barely stand. But,
we've seen that online, so it's okay.
Okay, yeah, you didn't hear it from me. I don't know. I've played chess with Woody Harrelson, I guess, which was quite fun. He's a really good chess player, actually. Very impressive. Who else? I remember I did some coaching at a chess event in London that was run by this great charity, Chess in Schools and Communities. And it was called Yes to Chess. It had American schools taking part. And so all these different schools would win different tournaments online, and they'd all come together for a live final. And I was coaching a bit at this event. I gave a simultaneous, and I was just around. And at one point we had this giant chess game, so on a giant chessboard. And I was doing the commentary on it, so I had a microphone. It was in the middle of Hyde Park. I don't know if you've been there in London. It's this huge park, and there was a music festival going on kind of every evening. So I was there with a microphone, kind of. It was empty at the time, the park. It was quite early in the day, and I was commentating on these kids playing against each other. And then suddenly I feel lots of people starting to whisper and kind of chatter and murmur. And I just looked kind of to my left, and there's this guy sat there in a wheelchair, and I looked again, and I thought, oh my God, it's Dave Grohl. And
oh wow,
yeah. So the lead singer from the Foo Fighters, and he was in Nirvana and everything. And so one of my favorite musicians. And he was because I think he had this accident, so he broke his leg. I think he fell off stage or something. And he was meant to perform at this concert, and instead, he was just having a holiday with his family in Hyde Park, and he stopped to watch the chess for a few minutes. And, yeah, and I did ask for an autograph, and I got rejected.
Oh no!
Or I asked for a photo or something, and because he was like, "Oh, sorry, I'm with family right now." And but yeah, I've met some cool people along the way, luckily, and I'm very thankful. That's one beauty of chess. You get to. I'm very appreciative. I've been able to travel a lot and meet some really cool people, and from lots of different cultures, and I wouldn't have otherwise been able to do that, I think.
Huh. Yeah, that's funny. So you recognized him even though he was in a wheelchair?
It took me like a double take or a triple take. It was just surreal. His leg was up in a cast. That was just a surreal day. I think I got all giggly because I had the microphone I was meant to commentate, and for a few minutes I think I was just standing there just staring. And I think people started to realize. Yeah, not my finest moment. Normally I try to keep my composure and play it cool and pretend that I'm just, I'm just as much of a rock star as Dave Grohl, but that one moment I was a fanboy.
Yeah, that's a high hurdle. He's a pretty big rock star.
Exactly.
All right, David, last thing, let's bring it back to your DVD. So sure. So I've watched about half the chapters. Do you want to hazard a guess as to what my favorite is so far?
Ooh. Oh, handling time travel? No.
Actually, I mean, I know that you're kind of well known for time travel issues, I talk about it so much on here that I've had time travel issues that I decided I was going to spare the listeners, and I haven't watched that part yet.
Okay, good. So, I mean, it definitely won't solve all the time travel issues. It's just a way of handling it better.
Right.
You get there. But,
No, it was the pattern recognition section.
Okay. I think I know the game you might like as well, where I tried to copy Nigel Short's famous King Walk against Jan Timman, and it just went, it backfired, and I got checkmated.
It was actually the Fischer one. I mean, of course, I'm familiar with both of these classics, but what David does is he shows you, very famous chess positions, and then talks about ways that he has attempted to or has successfully incorporated it in some of his own games.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing that, like, when I do coach younger players, I try and instill in them is that they do have to keep up with top games, or they do have to kind of read through these classics, because, I mean, it's just an easy way to pick up these ideas, to pick up these patterns, and they come up much more than you'd expect. I mean, you hear Magnus referring to all these games from the past, and if he didn't have those reference points, he wouldn't be such a strong player. And yeah, luckily this game, Fischer versus Benko, I managed to use this idea of blocking the pawn on f7 in one of my games, and yeah, Anish Giri was watching, Wesley So was watching. There was a big crowd around that board, and definitely one of my proudest moments in chess, probably. So
yeah, it was really cool. Definitely a reason for people to pick up the DVD.
Thanks for mentioning it. It was a lot of hard work, this DVD, and yeah, you'd be doing myself a great honor if you did enjoy it. All the listeners out there as well.
15 hours for, like, I think I paid $60 or something. I mean, obviously well worth it in terms of the ROI. And the entertainment and instructional value. So was Simon Williams, I mean, once or twice you could hear you, like, talking to whoever's, you know, the man behind the camera. Was it Simon Williams or Simon Ansell or someone else?
Simon was with me in the studio for half of it. I think in the end, he got sick of me. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I kept stopping and starting and trying to edit. And in the end, he was just like, "Come on, just film it. It's 15 hours. You know, it will take years if you keep redoing the whole chunks." And yeah, you mentioned earlier, they're in small chapters, so each chapter is about 15, 20 minutes on average. And often I would film a whole 15 minute thing. I'd be unhappy with one word that I said, and I'd go back and refilm everything. And I think he was just sick of me by the end of it. So. it was fun to do, and a lot of love went into it, and hopefully
it's hard to envision Simon as, like, a super exacting director, you know.
He wasn't at first, but you know, he had the worst protege to work with, I think.
Excellent. Well, David, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing all these experiences, and I'm really enjoying your new public persona.
Thanks, Ben. I'll try and keep it up as long as possible. And thanks.
Excellent.
Thanks too for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, I appreciate it. And you're on Twitter. Is there anywhere else for people who want to, like, see when you're doing banter blitzes and all that stuff? Is that the best way to keep up?
Yeah, that's right. So either Twitter, so it's at David Howell GM, or I'm trying to Instagram a bit more. So David Howell Chess is my Instagram. I do have a competition with a friend to get as many followers as possible, actually, with Fiona Steele-Anthony. So,
oh, she's tough.
Yeah, she's tough. Yeah, she's got a big head start. I didn't tweet for 2 years, and I think I've posted 10 times on Instagram in 3 years. But one day I'll get there. Hopefully we'll help everyone.
Okay, so yeah, guys, do him a favor. And David, thanks again. Stay safe during these crazy times, and look forward to seeing you online and in tournaments.
Yeah, cheers, Ben. It's been an honor. And yeah, stay safe, everyone.
Special thanks to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to you all for continuing to listen to and spread the word about Perpetual Chess. You can spread the word on Twitter. Follow me. I'm at BenEfficial1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the dialogue about each interview after it is released. I also want to thank the people who've written a few new reviews on Apple Podcasts. That's good to see. Reviews on other podcast platforms and YouTube are also appreciated. But of course, most of all, I would like to thank the people who provide financial support to the show, especially these days as a lot of our lives are in upheaval. We're stuck at home. There's work changes and all that stuff. So it means the world to me that you guys have stuck with me and even in some cases added new support in these crazy time. So thanks. I really appreciate it. For anyone who's able to support, it is the Perpetual Chest Patreon page, where you can donate through PayPal if you go to perpetualchestpod.com. So with that out of the way, first of all, of course, I would like to thank the sponsor of the show, Chessable. And I also would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities for their support. They include Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lorraine Dore, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Moonmaster 9000, Peter Sodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, and I also would like to give thanks to the following people and entities: Aaron Waffler, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Tarakov, Andrew Perry, Aniti Deer, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Courtney Fry, David Bleskacek, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Cramerly of Chessable.com, Douglas Matthew, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, or possibly not I am Elect, Donnie Ariel Esquire, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letarte Lavoie, Francis Tortorice, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutte, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovach, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Murr, Jason Anfang, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Stranad, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of the U.S. Chess Federation, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Alert, Miguel Araspati, Mike Clem, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solin, Neil Bruce, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Dougherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Thomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Wayne Beam, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Soyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I will catch you all soon.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.